Head to netsuite.com/briefing now for their one-of-a-kind flexible financing program.
Hey, everyone. I'm David Chalian, CNN's political director, and welcome to the CNN Political Briefing. We heard from voters again on Tuesday, and not just in the race for president. In fact, we had our eyes on some key down-ballot primaries. Remember, Republicans are attempting to hold on to this razor-thin majority in the House that they have, and Democrats only need a net gain of 4 seats to gain control in November's elections. As for the United States Senate, well, things are looking a little bleak there for Democrats as they try to hang on to their majority there, which is razor-thin. Erin Covey and Jessica Taylor cover the campaigns for the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, respectively, for the Cook Political Report. They're joining me today to talk about what we learned on Super Tuesday and what to look for next in the battle for the control of Congress. Jessica and Erin, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
So let's just start. As we are recording this the day after Super Tuesday, and there were a bunch of down ballot primaries of note, why don't you each give me your big takeaways about how Super Tuesday informs your thinking about the overall political landscape for battle for control of the House and Senate?
For the Senate, I think I'm going to have more answers, I think, in two weeks after Ohio. So we know that California is basically over, but this wasn't in the competitive column. So I think you can pretty much say hello to Adam Schiff. He got his chosen opponent after boosting Steve Garvey, the Republican former pro baseball player. And then the other big Senate primary of the night was where Democrats facing an incredibly tough map are trying to go on offense in Texas. So Colin Allred did avoid a runoff. He got over 50% of the vote. And so he's set up for a general election against Ted Cruz. So this is sort of Democrats' outside chance to have an offensive game scheme. But I think ultimately it's a race I'm pretty skeptical of in a presidential year. This is basically a defensive map that Democrats have everywhere.
Now, 6 years ago on the Texas piece, when we saw the Cruz-Beto O'Rourke matchup, it was a midterm year that was a huge sort of Democratic wave year. This one is going to be accompanied by a Trump-Biden presidential race at the top of the ticket in Texas. Does that change your sense of the shape of the Allred Cruz race?
It does, because what we have seen is that in presidential years, there are these Trump voters that come out that don't in midterm cycles in 2018 and in 2022. So I think that just fundamentally changes the electorate. And you have to go back to actually the Ted Stevens race in 2008, which had its own sort of special caveats, of course, to find a time when an incumbent senator was ousted when his party won the White House at the state level there. So it's very rare when that happens.
And Erin, how about, I know you focus on the House races. What were your big Super Tuesday takeaways?
Yeah, so it was a pretty big night for the House. We had a ton of competitive races in California. I think it's fair to say that the battle for control of the House is going to run through California and New York as well. But we had several important primaries in the Golden State, along with quite a few primaries and open seats in Texas and North Carolina and Alabama. So there was a lot going on. Most of the activity was on the Republican side, which was interesting. And it was kind of hard for me to see any clear kind of through line or trend from those primary results. There were some primaries where, for example, in Alabama's first district, the House Freedom Caucus member Barry Moore ousted Jerry Carl. They were in a member-on-member primary there that was spurred by redistricting. So that was interesting. But then you had other races where the more quote-unquote establishment Republican was successful. So it was kind of a mixed result across the board.
And in terms of some of those California races that you say may end up determining control of the House, any sense of now that we have the top two out of the primaries and these matchups, about how many California seats do you think we'll be watching come November?
Quite a few. I mean, there's a half dozen seats in California that Biden either won or narrowly lost that Republicans currently control. So that's quite a few. And then you also have a couple of Democratic-held seats that could be competitive. The most competitive is actually Katie Porter's seat that's left open since she was running for Senate. And that had an interesting primary to watch. That was probably the messiest Democratic primary of the cycle so far.
Why do you say that?
Well, you had a state senator, David Minn, who had actually run against Porter a couple of years earlier when she ran for the seat in 2020. 2018. He was seen as the clear front runner and had locked up a lot of support from California politicians, but he had a DUI last year that got a lot of attention. And the other Democrat in the race, Joanna Weiss, was supported by Emily's List and AIPAC, and they spent a ton of money, like over $4 million, attacking Ben. But surprisingly, it looks like he's going to come through. They haven't called that race yet, but last I checked, he was ahead by several points.
So I think it's fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I can try to just think through here conventional wisdom in Washington right now, is that Democrats have a real opportunity to flip control of the House and Republicans are poised to flip control of the Senate. Would you say that that is a fair assessment of conventional wisdom going into this November's elections?
I think it is, which runs a little counterintuitive to what one would expect. But I mean, I think it matters. You know, all of the House is up, but Democrats just were handed this really tough map. So it just depends which third of the Senate is up. And running in a presidential year is also changes things, too.
No doubt about that. You mentioned California for the House seats. Obviously, those New York House seats are critical, too. The overlay of the House map to the Senate map seems not so much. Those are two different battlefields that will be taking place.
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting because most of these competitive House seats are in states that aren't competitive at the statewide level. And so you have a lot of interesting battles, not just in New York and California, but in Washington State, in Oregon, even in like Connecticut. And these are all places that aren't going to have super competitive races at the top of the ticket, at least as far as the presidential goes. So it'll be interesting to see if Republican incumbents there can be able to separate themselves a bit more from Trump and the National Party. I'm a little skeptical, but, you know, these are going to be close races and it could come down to those margins and them being be able to do that with a couple of voters.
In talking to all these campaigns and candidates and operatives, do you guys get the sense that with a Biden-Trump rematch at the top of the ticket, two unpopular figures, that the sense of an overhang gets mitigated and that these Senate and House races will have more of an ability, perhaps, than usual in a presidential cycle to divorce themselves in voters' minds from that rematch at the top of the ticket?
I think if you're Democrats, you have to hope that. And when I look back historically, we have seen about 4 to 5 points is typically where you can hope to sort of outrun the president when we look back. So, you know, that's where a Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin has to look at right now. And I think that's about where she is when you look at the Biden numbers there. Unless you're sort of a superhuman in a way like John Tester, that he, you know, this is a state Trump won by 16, but he's still very much in the mix. And I think, you know, even though on paper he should be the most vulnerable incumbent we have, I think you cannot underestimate his political skill. And he's still very popular, which we don't see incumbents lose like that. So in 2022, we did see that candidates still mattered. That, you know, I kind of looked at 2022 as this climate versus candidate quality. And what Republicans are trying to do is address that candidate quality issue that they had in 2022. They have done that in some places, I think, like Montana, Nevada, but there's still questions about places like Arizona and which candidate's going to get through in an open seat in Michigan. So, you know, again, the primaries of the most competitive states for Senate that are going to decide the majority haven't started yet. So those are the big questions I have. But they have been successful, it has to be noted, in clearing primaries in Pennsylvania. You have David McCormick there that has a clear path now to taking on Bob Casey. But, you know, again, in our toss-up column, we have three there. Now we know that Arizona is going to be a two-way race with Kyrsten Sinema, who decided to pick Super Tuesday. Thank you, Kyrsten Sinema, to announce that she would not run.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
And on the House side, do you sense that the NRCC folks that are managing, you know, and looking at all these House campaigns are having to recalculate their approach with Trump at the ticket versus if it was another presidential candidate? Does Trump still create problems? Or, as Jess was saying, do they see him as just a generator of turnout and therefore they see him as a help to his House candidates?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is both. Yeah. And it varies district to district. Like, you have some districts that have like a larger white working class population that could probably disproportionately benefit from a Trump boost in turnout. But then you have a lot of other seats, and a lot of these are the ones in California and New York, where Republicans last cycle in the midterms were running double digits ahead of Biden, which is something you can do in a midterm cycle, but is more difficult to do in a presidential cycle. And I'll also say, to Jessica's point, you know, candidates do matter at the House level. We've definitely seen that proven, but it's really only a handful that ends up mattering at the end of the day, because it is much more difficult for House candidates to separate themselves from the national party because they're just like not well known.
Yeah, I'm just so intrigued by the fact that both of the presidential candidates are upside down with the American people, that it's not just an unpopular incumbent president that his party needs to outrun, but it's his party needs to outrun his unpopularity while there's also this other unpopular guy on the other side of the equation, and that may make the calculus a little bit different. Guys, stay right there. I've got a lot more questions for you as we dig in to this monumental election season that is beginning in earnest now that we are past Super Tuesday.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. We're here with House and Senate reporters Aaron Covey and Jessica Taylor of the Cook Political Report. Jessica, you mentioned Kyrsten Sinema's big announcement this week that she is not going to seek re-election in the United States Senate from Arizona. I know we haven't had primaries yet, but it looks like this is going to be the Democrat Ruben Gallego versus Republican Carrie Lake. And Carrie Lake, as you and I are sitting here, has been making her way through Washington, D.C. and rallying the Republican establishment behind her, despite her very Trumpy firebrand run in the gubernatorial race last cycle. She seems to want to be showing an approach that she could broaden her appeal, and yet, much like Donald Trump, has a hard time actually sticking through with that game plan, as she was already sort of chiding Nikki Haley on Twitter and mocking her and her candidacy, while yet trying to say that she's trying to woo all pieces of the party, including Haley supporters. So what does Sinema's departure mean for this critical battleground Senate race?
I still think it's a toss-up, because Arizona is was just one of the closest states last time, and it's just going to be a very close race. And, you know, again, someone like Lake is the type of candidate the Republicans wanted to avoid. To me, it's a very sort of marriage of convenience between the National Party and her. They see that she was going to win because she has this grip over the Republican base. So it's sort of, you might as well work with her than against her in that way. So you see them, like you said, they are saying, you know, look, she's being more disciplined. She's being a better candidate. I mean, her announcement speech a couple of months ago, she wasn't dialing down on the election conspiracy theories and different things. But we have to look back. She still has not conceded that she lost the governor's race. And like you mentioned, her tweet about Nikki Haley. So it does sort of feel like two steps forward, one step back. And this is why I'm a little cautious. Like, okay, can she really keep this under control when there is that sort of MAGA firebrand under there? And, you know, you look back at the Republican candidates that have lost, you know, in recent Senate elections, Martha McSally twice, that was more of a moderate, Blake Masters, who had a whole host of issues as well. But I think she is very out there on the right and has these liabilities. But then it has to be noted too that Gallego, who really sort of forced Sinema out of the party in a way, because he was going to challenge her in the primary, she was going to lose. He's also not a Mark Kelly. He's a member of the Progressive Caucus. He's much further left than Sinema or Kelly are. So it's sort of, where does the independent base go? So there's sort of two schools of thought. When you looked at those potential three-way races, Sinema was actually getting more of the Republican vote than she was the Democratic vote. So Lake has a challenge to get those Republicans back to her. And someone like Kelly might have been able, you know, he was picking off, you know, almost 10% in exit polls of Republican voters. But can Gallego convince those over to him? And then independents are, of course, the largest bloc, and Democrats have won those the past three Senate election cycles. Can Gallego win those the same way? So they've both got to appeal to the middle, but they both have liabilities in doing that.
Yeah. And again, just to go back to the overlay of the presidential, obviously, this is going to be one of the most contested battleground states in the Trump-Biden race. And does that also then complicate Gallego's quest to bring some of those Republicans over, because we're going to be in a polarized presidential environment? In fact, just looking at this very, very difficult map for the Democrats in the Senate, the overlay of the presidential, unlike in the House, is really substantial.
It's,
I mean, you have Senate races in Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. These are the states that are going to decide the presidential race.
Yeah, it's basically Georgia that doesn't have a Senate race this cycle. But other than that, it's mainly these Senate races, yes. But, you know, the math is just working against Democrats so much. Listen, in 2022, Democrats pitched a perfect game. They actually managed to gain a seat, which went against historical norms. But now we have to factor in the fact that Joe Manchin is leaving. That seat is going to go to Republicans. Then we're down to 50-50. If they only lose West Virginia, but they also lose the presidency, then the Senate's already gone.
Right.
You know, so then we're just talking about what other seats they can get. So Democrats have to completely run the table, but there is no scenario, basically, where they win the Senate unless Joe Biden wins.
Wow. Now, on the House side, there are, as I said, not as much overlay, but there are competitive seats in Pennsylvania, in Michigan. So talk to me about where you do see an overlap of the presidential race with the House races.
Yeah. So like you said, there's a couple of competitive seats in Pennsylvania, and these are kind of the usual suspects if you follow along with House races. So Matt Cartwright up in northeastern Pennsylvania is vulnerable, along with Susan Wild. And then in Michigan, you have an open seat here. This is actually one of the most evenly divided districts in the country, and it's open now because Alyssa Slotkin is running for Senate. And so that's going to be, I think, a really interesting test of how a pretty generic Democrat does against a pretty generic Republican. These are both two white 40-year-old men who are pretty aligned with the mainstream of their party. And so I think it'll be kind of an interesting test of that.
And it's a place where Republicans can be hunting to try and build up an insurance policy against what may be losses in New York and California, which is what have Democrats so hopeful that they can flip the House. Obviously, the House is so narrowly divided. What is the number that the Democrats need to win the majority? Four?
They only need four. Yeah, but they're losing three in North Carolina. They're gaining one in Alabama, probably gaining one in Louisiana. So it's a game of inches. But yeah, a lot of these races that they're going to be targeting are in California and New York. On the Democratic side, though, there are five Democrats who represent Trump seats, and several of these are going to be quite competitive. Jared Golden, obviously thought of as someone who has been able to outrun his party's brand, but Republicans have a pretty strong recruit there, so he could be quite vulnerable. You got Mary Peltola in Alaska, Marie Perez in Washington State. These are all seats where Democrats are going to have to be playing defense as well as offense.
And we had a special election in New York, Long Island, just a few weeks ago. What lessons did you learn out of that New York special election to replace George Santos, that Tom Suozzi won his old seat back on Long Island, that you believe, or I shouldn't say you learned, but that you have observed that Democrats and Republicans have learned, and how are they applying it to strategies going forward?
Yeah, so it's always hard to have big takeaways from special elections just because the turnout there is so different from like a regular election. But I will say there were some really interesting messages that were being tested in this race. On the Democratic side, Tom Suozzi really went on offense on the issue of immigration and was supporting the bipartisan immigration deal before that kind of fell apart. I thought that was interesting. Typically, Democrats are more focused on the issues that they know they do well on, such as abortion and just like kind of democracy in general. And so that was kind of interesting. It clearly paid off for him in Long Island. On the Republican side, side. I think their nominee really struggled to separate herself from the National Party and kind of just national Republican talking points, which was, again, a really stark weakness for her in comparison to Swazi, who had obviously represented Long Island before and was just very enmeshed in that district.
So you're not sure that there's a roadmap for other
No.
candidates going forward?
I think...
It's called special for a reason.
Exactly, yes.
Well, it is going to be a fascinating cycle, and I hope you guys will come back as the primary season rolls on, because our listeners benefit from such smart reporters who focus in on these down-ballot races every day. I appreciate your expertise. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
That's it for this week's edition of the CNN Political Briefing. And we want to hear from you. Is there a question you'd like answered about this election cycle? Is there a guest you really want to hear from? Give us a call at 301-842-8338 or send us an email at cnnpoliticalbriefing@gmail.com. And you might just be featured on a future episode of the podcast. So don't forget to tell us your name, where you're from, how we can reach you, and if you give us permission to use the recording on the podcast. CNN Political Briefing is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Madeline Thompson. Our senior producer is Haley Thomas. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is executive producer of CNN Audio. Support from Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lainey Steinhardt, Jamis Andrist, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namero. And special thanks to Katie Hinman. We'll be back with a new episode on Friday, March 15th. Thanks so much for listening.
Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/briefing. netsuite.com/briefing.